It's a human tendency to believe that our troubles are externally driven, that they're not really our fault. That our troubles come, you know, we run into problems, we all do, and there's a human tendency to believe that, well, actually what the problem is, we were misunderstood, misjudged. Maybe we were evaluated in a prejudicial light. Somebody really didn't take us exactly on that matter. They packaged it with some other incidents as well. We know our heart, and we know that really it's everyone else who gets confused about these things. It is a human tendency to believe that our problems and our trials are not generally our fault. In the church, we have some additional incentive on this because we're reminded that sometimes obeying God runs counter to society around us. When you keep the Sabbath and the holy days, that's different than what others are doing, and sometimes people will look at us as the ones indeed who are strange. If you're involved in school sports at some time, there might well be limitations to what you can participate in or what you can do. And your teammates will encourage you, maybe even pressure you, to do it the way they do it because you're the one who's different. Business requirements. There are different things we run into that encourage us in some ways to say that when we fail in this society, that we justify that as the society's problem as compared to our own. We tend to look at some of our troubles as being externally driven. And yet, we live in an easy time, do we not? We have peace, we have prosperity, we have freedom, we have legal protections in many ways. In general, we live in an easy time. Now, Christ lived in a hard time. He lived in a time when there was open persecution if you disagreed with the status quo. There was very little tolerance for diversity in his culture and environment that he was raised in. And there was very little, very temporary peace. There was always the threat of war, and rebellion or disturbance was put down severely. And yet, if we look at Christ's childhood and his attitude and approach, Luke chapter 2, there are some comments here that reference how he related to society at large and how society at large looked at him. Now, I'm not talking about the period of time where he was getting ready to be sacrificed. Obviously, that's a rather unique situation that we don't face. I'm not talking even about when he was out openly preaching the gospel and healing and doing very dramatic and miraculous things. I'm talking about when he was growing up and living in society kind of like the way you and I do. Not quite changing the whole course of human events. Verse 40 of Luke 2 says that he grew, because it's talking now about the years of his childhood, he grew and became strong in spirit, he was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was on him. So he had the blessing of God the Father in a very strong and significant way, but he also grew in terms of his attitude and his wisdom, his knowledge, and the way he applied the lessons that he learned. So he was maturing in that respect. And then it goes on in verse 41, it says, his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover, and he was 12 years old. And after the feast was over, they returned, and here it says, the boy Jesus, that's better than baby Jesus, right? At least we've stepped up, right? We got boy Jesus, lingered behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother didn't know it. He must have been, they thought, with other family members. Obviously, if you had a child that you couldn't trust, you'd keep him close and make tabs on him. But if you know the children are safe, then you give them more room. So there had to be some allowance here for the fact that they could depend on him and that he would do that which was right. Supposing him to have been in the company, they went a day's journey. They looked for him among their relatives and acquaintances. When they didn't find him, they went back to Jerusalem seeking him. 3 days later, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking questions. And all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. And when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said, son, why have you done this? Your father and I have sought you anxiously. And he says, look, I am about my father's business. They didn't fully understand what he was saying. But he, in verse 51, he went home with them and was subject to his parents. His mother kept it in, in her heart. And then in verse 52 is the point that is important here, at least in what I'm trying to address. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. He didn't, by worshiping God, alienate society around him. That's not what it says. Again, we're talking prior to his ministry, prior to the healings, prior to confronting the Pharisees. That's a rather unique situation. But as he grew up as part of that world society of his day, he was able to obey God and draw favor and grace from God, and also to build favor and grace with men as well. Sometimes, I think, we excuse ourselves with the church. If it doesn't work out on our jobs, if it doesn't work out in our neighborhood, if it isn't working out at school, if it isn't working out in the society as we participate, that's because we obey God. And I believe sometimes that is a rather limited picture. Because God says, at least in part, if we obey him, there ought to be fruit from that that is pleasing and satisfying and valuable to other people as well. Obeying God ought to improve our marriages, not hurt our marriages. It ought to be a way in which we raise our children in a better manner, not with more limitations and risks that puts them into some kind of danger of which we can't overcome. Jesus was someone that you would have wanted to have around. He was someone you'd like to have helped out on a project if you were working at the house, or if you were going to go on an activity, you would have enjoyed his company. Jesus was someone that would have been pleasant to be with. He made a positive contribution to the environment he was in, the society of his day, and he grew in favor and grace with men as well as with God. Now, what comes to mind when you hear the name Vic Kubik? And I pulled him out in particular. When you hear the name Vic Kubik, you probably think about somebody maybe helping, you know, the projects overseas, the Sabbatarian projects that we have announced and participated in and contributed towards are things that he and others who have assisted him have kind of taken up and ran with. Vic's a pleasant man to be around. You would enjoy sitting down to dinner with him. You would enjoy a conversation. He's pleasant to be around. I used to manage the church fleet program in Pasadena. And one of the last things the predecessor to me did before he no longer managed it was he bought a bunch of Peugeots. Do any of you remember your pastor driving a Peugeot? All right, they didn't hit up here. Mr. Waterhouse started it. Mr. Waterhouse didn't have an office. He didn't have a house. He had a car. And so he liked to drive something that was kind of different, and he got this Peugeot. And he would drive around the country in this Peugeot, and other men would see it, and they'd say, well, that's nice. I'd like a Peugeot. And so my predecessor had a connection with that and bought a bunch of these Peugeots. Volvo, that was after the Peugeot. I bought the Volvo, too. I did not buy the Peugeot. Jerry Cates is calling me on this. No, I bought the Volvo. He liked that. He had fun. But the Peugeot was before. And the Peugeot, Mr. Waterhouse had a special dispensation from God. He could, whatever car he got would work. And he just, because he drove everywhere every day, that's his whole living, and his car would always work. Well, all the other Peugeots were disasters. And Vic Kubik had one of the Peugeots. And so Vic's driving down the road, and the car caught on fire. And he bails out of the car. Somebody else stops, has a fire extinguisher, runs up, puts out the fire. It's burning under the dash, smoke's pouring out of the car. And they had to tow it into the nearest big community. Well, the Peugeots were from France, and that's where they stored all the parts, I think. And so when it came time to try to put this back together, which was one of the bigger mistakes I've ever made, was decide to fix this car. You know, it was tied up, and they got some things fixed, and they had to ship to France. And then, of course, the French Foreign Legion was using those parts in Algeria, so they had to go to the warehouse in Algeria to get the parts and ship them to France and then back. I'm joking, but it was hard to get this car fixed, and it was tied up for a long time. And Vic would send me updates. And they were kind of joking and humorous, but he's really, you know, stressed about having to deal with this and trying to get his car back and the problems that existed. Of course, then he got it back and it smelled like fire and it never did work quite right. Of course, you know, after that, you're afraid to really get it out on the road. You know, when if it burns up, you know, in the middle of the night or something. And so my first impression of Vic Kubik from back then was, here's this gentleman that has an incredible problem that I am fixing so that I can kind of perpetuate it. And yet his attitude stayed very, very good. And when he would call and tell me what had happened, he was quite congenial. Keith Walden had another one of those Peugeots. He related the story one time where he's driving across Texas in his car, and I don't remember if he rolled the window down or pulled the sunroof back. I think he pulled the sunroof back. This, you know, a luxury car has a sunroof, and it stuck. And then it rained, and he's in this car, this big open hole in it, driving, trying to get home. It's pouring down rain. He's soaking wet. Vic, I think, had a better attitude than Keith Walden had. So, yeah, everybody's not equal on these things, right? And Keith Walden baptized me, so I always try to get him back. But Mr. Waterhouse started the whole thing. Now, Proverbs 27 has a scripture about Peugeots. And I realize that's, you know, hard to sometimes work in, but if you try hard enough, there's always something. We think sometimes we're misjudged, misperceived, not understood, not given a chance. And sometimes that might indeed be true, but sometimes the problem is what is being perceived is what indeed we are. It's the way that we exist. And maybe we have somehow been excusing ourselves, justifying ourselves, or covering for the way that we really do think. Proverbs 27 and verse 19. As in water, face reveals face. When the water is still and you reach out over the edge and look and you see your face, it's a reflection of who you are. So a man's heart reveals the man. Sometimes, brethren, the way we come across is just simply the way we are. Now, it's sensitive to us when somebody reflects back on that to us. And it's easy to sometimes justify that somehow, because we're in the church and they're not, or because of some other reason, that we're right and they're wrong. But sometimes the reflection that comes back is just exactly who we are. Back in chapter 17 and verse 22, when our heart is right, when we're right with God, then we ought to, as much as possible, also be right with our fellow man. And there is a change in our countenance because what is inside now is being evident, but it's evident in a positive way. Proverbs 17:22. A merry heart does good like a medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. Now, if your heart is merry, if you're happy, if you're content, if you're positive, or whatever the descriptive term would be, it's not just your health that's affected. It's actually visible to other people around you. It's evident to others. When I say Vic Kubik, a positive association, chances are, is given in most people's minds. Because his character and nature becomes evident to those around him. A merry heart does good. Doesn't just do us good, it does good for those who are around us as well. Down back into Proverbs 14, just going back a little further in verse number 30. A sound heart is life to the body. When we feel good, when we trust God, when we're being positive and looking for the best, that has an impact. And it has an impact beyond our personal circumstance. But envy is rottenness to the bones. And so the way we think is oftentimes made evident, quite frankly, on the relationships that we maintain. Christ, obviously Christ was perfect and we're not going to be there, but Christ living in us, we ought to be on our way there. We ought to be partway there. We ought to be striving for that. And we ought to have in our lives, frankly, a growth in favor, both with God and with man. That should be God's Spirit working in us. If we're positive and we're outgoing and we're pleasant, you think people would resent that overall? Or do you think people would be drawn to us? Now, some people are outgoing, but they're not pleasant. That's a little different. Some people are just plain obnoxious. But other people are quite pleasant, and nobody has any idea because they keep totally to themselves. But if you're pleasant and positive and outgoing, then I think people will notice that, and by and large, it's going to be appreciated and enjoyed. It's a contribution, and it's one of the ways that we would develop favor with man around us. If we strive to edify and to encourage, if we strive to lift others up, if we strive to look for good qualities, to reinforce positive attributes, if we do that, then we are generally going to be well received. I'm not saying every single person, every single place. I'm just saying if we do that, we will generally be well received. I think that's what God would intend us to do. That's what Christ's own example was. God's pleasant to be around. When you picture God, what do you picture? Kind of a cowering duck? Or do you imagine that God would be really pleasant to be around? Psalm 16 is listed as a miktam of David as compared to a psalm. Now, I want to show you something. Psalm 16. Look at Psalm 15. Now, my New King James says that this is a psalm of David, Psalm 15. Psalm 16, it's a miktam of David. Psalm 17 is a prayer of David. And so they're not all the same. A prayer, a psalm is a song, and generally it was designed to be played on stringed instruments. A prayer is a prayer. A miktam is a little bit different than that. Now, there isn't a clear consensus on what the root of it is, but one of the early rabbinic teachings related it to the word for gold. And the concept was that this was considered to be a very precious or an especially precious concept or message. And so I'd like to at least look at it in that regard. Psalm 16, I'd like to read it. And look at this in terms of what it would be like to be with God. Preserve me, O God, for in you I put my trust. O my soul, you have said to the Lord, you are my Lord. My goodness is nothing apart from you. And to the saints who are on the earth, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. Their sorrow shall be multiplied who hasten after another god. Their drink offerings of blood I will not offer, nor take up their names on my lips. You, O Lord, are the portion of my inheritance and my cup. You maintain my lot. The lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. If you're looking at God as your leader and as the one whom you look and follow, and the description then says, the lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. Yes, I have a good inheritance. If we were to look at our calling, do we look at it as an improvement in our circumstances or just potential for the future? Do we look at it as something better now, a change now that we would say, yes, what's fallen to me, my lines, or the lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. I have a good inheritance. I will bless the Lord who has given me counsel. My heart also instructs me in the night seasons. I've set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be moved. Therefore, my heart is glad and my glory rejoices. My flesh will also rest in hope. Now, there's a passage here where David is referencing the fact that he won't end up in the grave forever, that God will raise him up. And then there's a prophetic reference to the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who would not see corruption. But in verse 11, you will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. It's speaking about being in God's presence. And it says it's pleasant, it's fullness of joy, it's a very positive and wonderful thing. And if God is in us, then we should have a measure, obviously, of this as well. Now, I know we have hard struggle in times and circumstance that we walk through, but God just says that if he's in us, there ought to be a pleasant countenance by some percentage as a result, to the degree that that is evident in what we do. In fact, the Bible records that by doing so, we become a witness, which I've recently addressed, but 1 Peter 2 talks about actually by our example, in a positive way, putting to silence those who are not responsive to God as they should be. In 1 Peter 2, in verse number 13, it says, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or to governors, or to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of those who do good. It's not setting us up in contention with government. It's not making us the exception of which we're always being persecuted. It's saying to submit within that system, obviously, putting God first. For this is the will of God. It makes us a good citizen, an honorable citizen, contributing and producing for God's own example in us, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. As free, yet not using your liberty as a cloak for vice, but as servants of God, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Doesn't say make fun of the king, mock society, but love the church. It says be respectful, be honorable, show love, and what's going to happen? By and large, you're going to grow in favor and in the grace of both God and of men. Who in the Bible was known for their encouraging approach? Very encouraging approach. Whose name in the Bible means encouragement? Barnabas. Okay, so we know the story of Barnabas. It was Barnabas who took Saul to the apostles in Jerusalem where nobody else would touch him. Saul's converted. God begins to use him. And Barnabas is the one that goes out and takes him effectively by the hand and walks into the apostles in Jerusalem and says, I'd like you to meet someone here and I'd like you to see what God's been doing. It was Barnabas who made that chance, took that chance. It was Barnabas who restored John Mark to usefulness in the church. And I would like to read a little bit on that in Acts chapter 15. We have an example of an individual who they actually gave him the name Barnabas because it means son of consolation or encouragement. And so he took on a name that actually represented, as face answers to face in water, his attitude and approach was so obvious that they gave him a name that represented it as well. Acts 15. In the wrong place. Verse 36. Paul had made his first journey and he's ready to make the second journey. As it's shown, many of your Bibles in the back have maps and there'll be a second journey listed on there. And it says, Paul said to Barnabas, Let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we've preached the word of the Lord and see how they're doing. Now Barnabas was determined to take with them John called Mark. But Paul insisted that they should not take with them the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to do the work. John Mark had abandoned the journey before under duress and basically just maybe went home. And Paul said, look, I can't trust him. I can't depend on him. I'm not going to go out there, put my life at risk, and have somebody walk out. Barnabas basically saying, give him a chance. He made a mistake, but he's still useful to us. Paul said, no, they argued over it. There was contention. Can there be contention in the church of God? There can be. Is that justification to go out and cause people to follow you as a person instead of the body that was together? No, it is not. You never ended up with a church of Barnabas or a church of Paul. They contended with each other, but they never divided the body in the process. And that allowed for the time when they could then restore to each other, and the brethren did not have to restore as well. Paul could easily have had a following and started a body that was loyal to him. He chose not to do so. And it speaks well of his character. The contention was so sharp they departed from one another. So Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus. Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of God. And he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. The good news is in 2 Timothy. And that's the other side of this here. In 2 Timothy chapter 4. Verse number 9. Paul here is in a tough spot. He's writing to Timothy. He says, be diligent to come to me quickly. Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and has departed for Thessalonica. Crescens for Galatia, Titus for Dalmatia. Now, it doesn't say that Crescens and Titus abandoned him, but they were gone, and the other one that he had to support him abandoned him and left him alone. Only Luke is with me. Get Mark, John Mark, the reference going back to that earlier account, get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for ministry. Who was the one who stood up for Mark and said, give him another chance? It was Barnabas. It's a very remarkable account. It's possible, and again, I only say it's possible, but it's possible without Barnabas, this would have never taken place. Because John Mark would not have continued in service in that way and would have been set aside. And here there was an opportunity to actually restore and go forward. You know, people who have positive perspectives and outlooks on this life don't necessarily have easy lives. It's not like because their life is easier, it's easier for them to be positive. That's not how it works. Sometimes we'd like to think that. Paul, so many times, took beating. He took stress. He went without food. He struggled with many things. And he turned around and he said, you know, this is sufficient for me. In fact, he said, if need be, I'll rejoice in my trials. If in being weak, that means God will use me more, then I will actually learn to rejoice in the fact that I struggle, because then God's work will get done. Now, I don't think when he says he rejoiced in his trials that he walked around complaining, moping, gritting his teeth, and constantly with his countenance down. I think he had to struggle through the trials, no question, but I think he took a positive approach. I think he would have had to, at the very least, say, it's all going to work out all right. This, too, will pass. It'll be better tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll do something else. There had to be more than just gritting his teeth and dragging himself through the trials that he faced. Brethren, we have trouble. God understands that. We have sadness. We have trauma. God understands that, but our mourning should not last forever. Our mourning should be there, be resolved, be healed, and we should be able to go on. Psalm 30 in verse number 4. Sing praises to the Lord, you saints of His. Give thanks at the remembrance of His holy name. For His anger is but for a moment. His favor is for life. God's anger is a moment in time, but His ongoing countenance, His favor, is into eternity. Weeping, and now it's talking about us. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. Our traumas should pass. Our emotional injuries should heal. Our struggles and our tears come, but then they should also go. And our countenance should be restored again. If we're going to have favor with man in this life, our countenance will have to encourage that. When we lived in Omaha, Nebraska, there was an article in the paper about a 105-year-old lady, very, very positive. And I'd like to read you just a short article. I saved it in my files, and I was reading it, and it's really interesting, I think, just to see her attitude and approach. And again, think in terms of what was her life like? What was it like? It says, the hands draw notice first, the fingers are straight, the hands are strong as Sally Williams gestures to give emphasis to her conversation. Behind the hands are sparkling eyes and an almost unlined face, a ready laugh and sure, swift recall of past events. Can Sally Williams really be 105 years old today? Now, she's dead. She died at about 106. And it's a few years back when this took place. But she was alive at this time when it was written. She shares her birthday with the United States. Her birthday was the 4th of July. And is almost half as old as the nation. But to hear Mrs. Williams tell it, it's no big deal. Seems like there ought to be a lot of people as old as I am, she said. Mrs. Williams gives clear indication that she feels what you do is more important than when you do it. As examples, she learned to read and write and do math when she was 95. She didn't have the education, the benefits, the opportunities that we would all in many ways take for granted. 2 years ago, at 103, she rode the bus home alone from Rochester, Minnesota, Mayo Clinic there, after having a serious operation. But Mrs. Williams doesn't want to talk much about hardship. She says, I'm having a wonderful life. Born in 1884 on a cotton farm near the southwest Alabama town of Hope, she was one of 15 children. That was the year the cornerstone of the Statue of Liberty was laid in New York. A couple of weeks after Mrs. Williams was born, the Democrats nominated Grover Cleveland for president. He was elected that November. Mrs. Williams said she recalls a day in 1901 when she was 17 and was picking cotton with other family members when somebody from town came out and told Mom and Dad that McKinley had been shot. Mrs. Williams, who says she could pick 600 pounds of cotton in a day, said the news devastated the farmers because McKinley had promised to give us another penny on the price of cotton, from 4 cents to 5 cents. But we got the penny later anyway. She said she came to Council Bluffs. She lived right across the river from Omaha. She said she came to Council Bluffs about 1917 and worked cleaning railroad coaches for the Burlington and Missouri Pacific Railroads. I can't believe it. She didn't get to go skiing, she didn't get to have parties, she didn't live on the river, she didn't get to go on vacations to the beach. And she said, I'm having a wonderful life. Now, what's wrong with this person? Her inability to read and write did present some problems, but she says you could pick some of it up along the way. At 95, she took classes at Omaha's Metropolitan Community College to learn to read and write. What does she read most? Folks send me a lot of books, but she says, I like to read the Bible. Mrs. Williams does her own housekeeping and gardening, attends St. Paul Baptist Church in Omaha, and keeps up with national and local events. She's an active member of the Bluffs Citizens for Community Improvement. She attends city council meetings recently and says, will she be ready for next year's 106th birthday? Of course, she didn't know, but she died shortly after that. But here's her comment. She says, I might be, but I might be in glory, and if I am, I'll be looking down on all of you and smiling. Now, I think it's great. I mean, who cares that she didn't know that she don't die and go to heaven? She said, if I'm up there, I'm going to look down and smile at all the rest of you and be waiting for you to arrive. I mean, she had a wonderful attitude and approach. Now, I know that it's not so easy as just saying I'm going to be wonderful and we're wonderful. But I think that's part of the solution, is it not? If we're thirsty, then we take a drink. If we're hungry, we eat. If we're tired, we rest. And if we want to be a nicer person, then we start to activate that process in our mind. And we ask God to miraculously intercede, to give us that desire and the capacity and the willingness to be more outgoing and receptive and to encourage and help others around us. It's not just a physical process with God and His people. It's a miracle. It's part of the Holy Spirit giving its evidence in us so that we would grow in favor and by our example be ambassadors for Christ, which I addressed recently. Good ones. The kind that others look at and say, boy, your life seems to be working. What is it you do that I need to know? Psalm 100, I am using the Psalms a little more heavily today. Happiness is a choice. It's not a series of events. We tend to process, well, if I get to go to the water park, if I get to do this, if I have my joy and dreams fulfilled, if I have these opportunities, if the garden produces, we tend to think in terms of a series of events producing happiness. Happiness is a choice. It's a way of life. It's an attitude. Psalm 100. Make a joyful shout to the Lord, all you lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Not with the grinding of the teeth and the struggling and the bitterness of heart. Serve Him with gladness. Come before His presence with singing. We're singing out, and the very first song we sang was one we all knew, and you could just hear the room fill with the singing. And Megan says, boy, you know, it was exciting because there was so much noise. And then the next song, we didn't know quite as much, and it was a little quieter, and then we had a hard time hitting some of the notes. But you could hear this just swelling noise fill the room, and it was exciting. It says, come before His presence with singing. Know that the Lord, He is God. It's He who made us, not we ourselves. We are His people, the sheep of His pasture. Enter into His gates with thanksgiving, into His courts with praise. Be thankful to Him. Bless His name. The Lord is good. His mercy is everlasting, and His truth endures to all generations. That's a way of life. That's not a series of circumstances that we bump into. Those are things we consciously do and pursue. What we do, brethren, how we do it, has a considerable impact on how this world sees us and on the favor that we receive. Paul said that we should learn to live in peace as much as it lies within us with all men, that we should seek peace and pursue it. 1 Peter 3 addresses that. Paul was referring to, the scripture I was referring to in Paul came out of Romans 12, but 1 Peter 3 refers to this conscious effort, a choice to be a peacemaker, to seek it out. 1 Peter 3 and verse number 8. It says, all of you be of one mind. Have compassion for one another. Love as brothers. Be tender-hearted and courteous. Don't return evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing. Knowing that you were called to this. We were called to be like Christ, that you may inherit a blessing. For he who would love life and see good days, he who would be profitable and fruitful and joyful in this life, Let him refrain his tongue from evil, his lips from speaking guile. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it diligently. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. The point being made is that God intercedes on our behalf miraculously to bring it to pass. He intercedes to bring it to pass. His ears are open to their prayers, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. And to the degree that we draw back and do not pursue God and give evidence to him in us is to the degree that he is not active and open and visible in our lives. It is so important to understand. Ephesians 4, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Where do you think sarcasm falls? That very common and popular means of communication in our society, sarcasm, where do you think that falls on the scale here? Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Colossians 4, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. You know what made President Reagan so likable in some ways as a president? He laughed a lot. He joked. Sam Donaldson, I remember hearing Sam Donaldson one time on the news, and Sam was always out there, bulldog, just trying to bite him and chew right into him, you know, and get some question. And Ronald Reagan would laugh or make a joke, or if he made a mistake, he'd laugh at himself. Or sometimes, and I heard him, you know, one time Sam Donaldson's out there trying to get at him about something he didn't want to answer, and he kind of laughed, and there was noise around, and he made like he couldn't hear, you know. And Sam Donaldson knew good and well he was lying, and he just smiled at Sam and laughed and pointed to his ears that he couldn't hear as he's leaving. And yet Sam Donaldson got on TV later, and I saw and watched it. He says, you know what I liked about President Reagan? I liked his humor. I liked the fact that he could laugh at himself. It actually endeared him to the man who in that way became his opponent in order to try to get information for the news. You can say a lot of things with humor where there's a genuine approach that you can never say any other way. You know, Mr. Armstrong used to have a picture on the wall in his bathroom, and I think it was a little boy relieving himself. I don't know how else to say it. And it was in the bathroom, and he thought that was funny. And it was in a semi-private type place, but you know, if somebody was there and used the bathroom, they saw it, they might, how could this be? But Mr. Armstrong thought it was kind of funny. One of my relatives used to, maybe still does, because I haven't been in their current house, but one of my relatives used to have a cow pie on the wall in their bathroom. See, the bathroom is where you hide all this stuff, right? Used to have a cow pie there, and they spray painted the cow pie gold, and then they glued it to a piece of black velvet. And then it was in a gold leaf colored frame. And they hung it as a piece of artwork in the bathroom. And then they listed the artist at the base of it, and the artist was A period cow. A cow. I always liked it. I thought it was great. Now, it's a cow pie, and some could say that's pretty distasteful. Fine, don't eat it. Just look at it and laugh. We have in our bathroom, and have had over the years, a picture of me naked. You can't use our bathroom. But I'm a little boy, and my two brothers who are older than I were all turned around, facing backwards, next to the tub, and Mommy made us all line up like that and took the picture. And so she circulated this to the family, and then when Michelle and I were dating, somehow or other I was joking to her about this family secret, you know. And so she called my mother and actually got a copy of it and had it brought down. And now I'm old enough that I don't care, and it's in a reasonably private place, and so it hangs there, buff for everyone to see. It's funny. Now, maybe it's not funny to everybody, but funny to us. This world's humor is often crass. I don't think some of these more private things are little children. I mean, we have a picture. This is great. They're going to hate me. The worst thing about having a minister as your dad is just there's no private life, you know. But, you know, as Megan and Derek grew up, I don't know, I think Michelle had a picture of her brother Don in cowboy boots when he was naked, little tiny tyke, and the boots come up to your waist, you know. And so she did that with Megan and Derek and tucked them in our files. We think they're cute. Now, we don't put them on the internet, all right, you know. But we think they're funny. And we keep them real quiet and private and don't let anybody else see. But, I mean, that's a lot different than this world's humor. This world's humor oftentimes, as I said, is crass, it's sarcastic. It pokes fun at somebody's expense. Our humor should reflect our relationship to God. And there is nothing that I have described or expressed that I felt was outside that box in terms of what personal examples I've given. Our humor should reflect our relationship to God. By using humor and by being lighthearted and by sometimes laughing at our own mistakes, we will endear ourselves, frankly, in various ways to those around us. I've had people that have contacted us after years and maybe hadn't seen them for years. You know what they remember? They don't remember any scriptures I gave. They don't maybe even remember too many. They might remember a few specific examples, but they tell me they remember that I laugh at my own jokes. And they just couldn't believe it the first time. But they remembered that, and there's a fondness that they have somehow in that type of relationship. Christ grew up growing in favor with God and man. And I don't think we should excuse ourselves from that process. I don't think we should discount the fact that because the society, this is Satan's world, and we're in the church, and we're in opposition, and all of a sudden we're different. I don't think that excuses us from being the type of people that others would like to be around as well, that would be encouraged by or enjoy the companionship of. Ultimately, we do need to realize that happiness is a gift from God. As I said, let's not ever discount the miraculous process of God's intervention in our lives. In Psalm 4, going back to the book of Psalms again, Psalm 4, verse number 4. It's addressing here. It says, "Be angry and do not sin." Fine, there are tough times. There is weeping at night, but there's joy in the morning. Then let it pass, but let it stay within the law, within the bounds, the proper bounds. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. Think about it, process it, but heal and go on. Answer the question and go on. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness. Put your trust in the Lord. There are many who say, who will show us any good? Lord, lift up the light of your countenance upon us. You have put gladness in my heart more than in the season that the grain and wine was increased. Now, there's a certain kind of joy that comes from having an ice cream cone or a steak or a big fat paycheck or a nice house or a fancy car. There's a certain kind of joy that comes with that, and yet this says, you have put gladness in my heart more than in the season that the grain and wine was increased. A miraculous, godly joy that supersedes physical pleasure and satisfaction. I will both lie down in peace and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. To be able to actually go to bed at peace, not troubled, not stressed, not worried or fearful or afraid, that is a gift of God. because we trust him, we look to him, we rely on him. We can grow in favor with God and man in this life, but only as we give evidence of the love of God that he puts in us, his own nature and his mind. Everything we say will not be soft words. It's not saying that we sign off on reality. Everyone will not identify with what we represent, but God does clearly show that our actions and our words, combined and directed by his blessing and grace, can be well spent. Let's not fall short of our potential to do good, brethren. Let's grow in favor both with God and with man.